Hi, it's Paul Camilos. Welcome to Series 6 of Shooting the Breeze. Join me and my co-host Jacinta Govind alongside the STB crew as we cover women's hoops and women in hoops. We'll share conversations and get a little deeper with inspiring players, amazing coaches, and the legends from behind the scenes. Especially in this series, we'll be talking to dream chasers that give it their all and lead with their heart.
I do think one component of evaluating, though, is that usually what you see is correct, right? So if someone performs really well, you like them, they're probably going to translate. It's probably going to be good. It's rare that it doesn't. But just because someone is not playing well at that level doesn't mean that they won't translate, I think is the other part. There might be a variety of different reasons.
We're thrilled to have James Jansen return to the pod. After joining us briefly for our 150th episode, we definitely wanted to hear more from the Aussie assistant coach of the Davidson Wildcats women's team from North Carolina. James takes us deep into their program, including the pipeline of exceptional Aussie female talent that are becoming hallmarks of the Wildcats. It's a really fascinating look into the significant progress of the college's women's basketball program, which James has been integral to, but especially against the sizzling backdrop of US women's college hoops. The podcast was taped last month, but as of last week, it was announced that Davidson will withdraw from the season in order to provide optimal care and support for the well-being of their players and staff in what's been a season of devastating loss from injuries, notwithstanding their impressive on-court results. You can only imagine how tough it was for them to have to make that decision. But perhaps, as James himself alludes to, the college is known to make good on their promises to their athletes, and prophetically, the importance for organizations and athletes to be intentional in self-care and sometimes the need to step back and evaluate. Welcome to Shooting the Breeze. Joining me, my co-host Jacinta Govind, and we've got back James Jansen from Davidson College. James, great to have you on the show again, and we can get into a lot more stuff in relation to what's happening for you.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
Let's, again, just for anybody who may not have been listening to the last time you were on, don't understand why, but maybe, let's catch up a little bit on how the season's been tracking for the Wildcats so far.
The last time we spoke was about 3 or 4 weeks before our season started. We were in preseason and kind of gearing up for things to get rolling. And I think a lot of the things that I'd probably mentioned on that call last time have actually come to fruition a little bit. So we kind of, through our non-conference season, we were able to get a couple of marquee wins, including a program first win at Duke Blue Devils in Cameron Indoor, which was really exciting way to kind of kick off our season. We played a bit of a heartbreaker against University of North Carolina as well that same week, and kind of continued on through our non-conference to a spot where we were actually receiving votes in the AP top 25 poll, which was the first time in program history that we'd been doing that. We also kind of were ranked among the top 40 teams in the country in the NCAA's net, which is kind of the ranking of all teams within college basketball. And yeah, at the end of our non-conference play and going into the new year, we were sitting at 11-1 in a really good spot, riding a 10-game win streak, which was tied the longest in program history. And kind of conference play rolled around, and we took a couple of bumps early. We had a couple of players actually go down with knee injuries in the same game in the start of January and dealing with a few other injuries, and we've kind of dropped a few. And now at a point where we're sitting at 6-5 in conference play, and I think kind of found some footing over the last week or so in terms of what the new version of us is going to kind of look for. And yeah, we've got about a month left in our season, about seven regular season games, and then the conference tournament. And I think sitting at what now 16-6, being in a really good spot for us to kind of make some noise come the pointy end of the season.
You just mentioned you've got seven regular season games coming up, and you've got a bit of travel there. New Hampshire, Chicago.
Yeah, we've got, yeah, so basically Rhode Island. We've got Chicago this weekend.
Rhode Island, yeah.
Head out to St. Louis, and then we also head to Dayton. Yep. So, yeah, a little bit of travel coming up.
A little bit of travel. And before we actually started recording, we were having a bit of a talk about just stuff in general and the fact you guys are in Charlotte, North Carolina, and it's the heart of NASCAR country. And you mentioned that there's an interesting connection between the college and one of the NASCAR teams.
Yeah, so through this phase of the year, we do kind of fly private planes quite a bit, and which is kind of part and parcel for this level of college basketball to be traveling that way. You're dealing with, once again, a lot of travel that you mentioned all over the country. And so we actually, yeah, we have a relationship with Joe Gibbs Racing, one of the local NASCAR teams, to fly their private plane. And so it works out really nicely. We get to practice here, and the kids get to go to school here and then fly out that evening. And then, yeah, we get to come home immediately after the game's over and be back in our own beds pretty close to midnight, which is definitely a nice setup. And obviously that's an issue right now in the WNBA that they're pushing for, to be able to kind of have some travel that reflects more of what their college experience was. And, yeah, really fortunate to have that.
And I'm guessing Joe Gibbs gets good seats for the games if he ever wants to show up.
Yeah, I think their racing team probably gets looked after pretty good.
I suppose one of the things that I was always curious about is, if you think back to your early days as a coach to where you are now, do you think there's been a lot of changes in your coaching style that's come from, you know, being exposed to the US college system?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting kind of thought experiment to kind of think about how some of those the kind of coaching habits or coaching style has changed over that time. Like I moved over here at age 26 and mostly coached junior basketball, obviously played at the kind of semi-professional level and the kind of big V setup and whatnot. But yeah, I think it's kind of hard in some ways to consider, okay, well, what's just changed because of your development as a coach and those things versus the specific exposure to the U.S. college game. And I think one thing that I would point to specifically about kind of the college environment I'm part of right now is that the Atlantic 10 Conference is quite diverse from a basketball stylistic standpoint. Obviously, you have a 30-second shot clock over here, a little different than the 24 seconds. You've got coaches that are been coaching a really, really long time or in their first time as head coaches, and obviously spanning way different exposures to each other as well. And so I think I've learned a lot from having to deal with that on a week-to-week basis, right? And in really a every three-day basis of these games right now, of you might step into one game and you're playing against a team that's really ball screen heavy, really pick and roll heavy with the way they play. And the next game, you're playing against a team that plays mostly five out motion, right? And plays in that way and has a lot of cutting and moving. And so I think the element of being really perceptive of what those styles are and being really adaptive and understanding how to morph both our offense and defense to respond to what teams bring. I think that's really been shaped by those exposures. Now, if the question is, hey, do you prefer more one-on-one isolated basketball because you're in America? Well, I think obviously the answer to that is categorically no. Like, we want to play a very internationally recognized style of basketball here and moving the ball and playing in that way. And so I don't think I've been influenced in that way, but I do think obviously the exposure of being involved in the NCAA college basketball for this now being my 12th season, it's hard to pass out some of those influences that I've had.
And when you play against teams, like you mentioned, there are a lot of college teams, men and women, who have had the same head coach for a very, very long time, you know, a dynasty.
Yep.
When you have to play against some of those teams that have had that same head coach for a long time, does that make it harder or easier to scout?
Yeah, I think in some way it makes it easier to scout in terms of to know what they're going to do, right? But for a lot of those people that have had lots and lots of success at doing what they do, they clearly do it really well, right? And so maybe one thing to know what they're going to do, maybe a whole different beast for you to be able to stop that or find ways. Like, often they've got answers for everything, right? And so I think that's one thing that pops up a little bit. Like, we have a team in our conference who has a head coach that's been there for 25 years now or so. And yeah, she's running the same thing that she was running when we first got in the league 7 years ago, and is having a lot of success with a lot of those things. And so, yeah, I think it makes it tricky from the standpoint of, hey, you do have to beat them, but there is pretty good consistency year to year with what most coaches typically do. And I think that's a positive, right? I think that speaks to good coaching, where you have people that aren't changing drastically year to year with their philosophies and systems. I think that would be very challenging within a collegiate environment to play that way.
And having an answer to everything, you can definitely imagine that those long-term coaches, I mean, you've been there a long time as well. I'm sure you've got lots of answers to everything that might pop up your way during a game, but that's not always the case. I don't think you can ever have an answer to everything all the time, especially in a pressure situation.
Yeah, and I think probably over the course of time, like I think a lot of those coaches have pretty simple systems, right? They have pretty simple systems, they have simple actions, and they have an ability to kind of toggle things in the way that they need to kind of get you to guard something a certain way. Or often they got really good players too, right? That's the other part, is they typically know how to get their best players the looks that they want to get them at key moments. And so that's probably what I've found over the course of time is that. And then I think the other part that you see from those long-term mature coaches, they've usually got a really good feel for what their defensive identity is going to be. And not just that, but also building in kind of adaptability to their defensive system that makes it quite hard to play against. And so, yeah, I think it's definitely interesting. And once again, not every coach is that way, but yeah, there's a lot of coaches with a lot of experience coaching at this level.
Because then having the having a really simple system, I like having really simple systems, things that aren't too rigid in sets and almost like choreography,
yep,
where everything has to be so specific, because then your players, it's still simple systems allows your players to still play freely and allows a lot more read and react, which I think over time was lost a little bit. The focus on read and react was lost a little bit in general. And that then is going to be much harder to guard than something as set and structured, like the same set play over and over with, you know, a couple of wrinkles.
Yeah, and that's kind of how we build our system, is like we're a motion style offense that, so yeah, it's based on a lot of different reads and spacing and making things really hard to have kind of answers for everything. Or once again, the answer for everything isn't necessarily always the best thing, but having ways that you can kind of manipulate or make the defense wrong is a really big important thing. And so I think we've done a nice job of that. I think that's why we're among the more efficient offenses in the country, is because we're just really hard to guard in that way. And a lot of that comes down to having good players too, right? That's the other part of it.
You have 5 Aussies on your roster at the moment. And the one that I want to talk about first is Charlize Dunn, who was with Virginia Tech, I think, for her freshman season, entered the portal and has now landed luckily with the Wildcats. And she is just thriving since she has transferred to Davidson. So tell us a little bit about Charlize and how she's going in the program and what you think it is that or why you think it is that she's thriving so much now she's with your group.
Charlize was a kid that was really highly regarded in her junior career in Australia, and saw her the first time at under 16 national championships, where she was a terrific player, spent some time at the Center of Excellence, and was part of the under 19 Gems team that won a silver medal at the World Championships in 2021 with Izzy Morgan and Millie Pryor in our team as well. And I think when we kind of kept an eye on what she was doing at Virginia Tech and that things weren't quite working out for her in that situation, and she entered the portal, she was someone we were really excited to potentially integrate into what we do. I think she's a kid who has a lot of talent, and I think a lot of ability to continue to grow as a basketball player as well that had not been seen. And she kind of hit the ground running on a trip to Spain that we went on in August, and was a really key component of some of those early wins, played a really nice game at North Carolina and did some terrific things against Duke. And just at her size, at kind of 6'2", and being able to shoot the ball like she can, she just moves incredibly well, has obviously really, really helped her adapt. And I do think that when you talk to what's different between now and last year for her, I think that it can't be understated how just feeling comfortable in your own skin can really lead to great performance. And I think the comfort that she had being around some familiar faces in terms of people that she'd played with before, people that she'd lived with before, and Millie while she was at the COE, and just kind of having that trust in what we're trying to do has been really big for her. And doesn't mean it's all been sunshine and rainbows. Like she through the start of January, she had a little bit of a tougher stretch, but following kind of the injuries that we had at the start of that month, she's really blossomed in the last couple of weeks. And a lot of that has come from her ability to score the ball in the paint as well and use her physicality and use her length to score the ball inside the perimeter too. She'd been shooting the ball from three really well. She'd been really good from that component, but kind of diversifying her scoring has been a big deal. Like this week, she probably should have been the A-10 player of the week. She averaged, I think, 24.5 points a game. And really her ability to impact things with her length on the defensive end too has been pretty remarkable. Like she's an elite shot blocker. And I think, in my opinion, her comparison for potential future Opals or potential future professional career is someone like Beck Allen. I think there's a lot of similarities between both the way they play, their build, what they can bring teams. And so, yeah, excited to have her for the next couple of years as well and continue to grow her game.
Yeah, that's great because Charlize and Olivia Pollard have been two people, two Aussies from the same vintage. When I say vintage, I mean era. I mean, they're not even anywhere near vintage status yet because they're only like what, teenagers, early 20s. Two Aussies who entered the transfer portal last year and are now just thriving at their new colleges, so that's really nice to see when you're watching from afar. And the other one we've got to ask about is Rosie. She's rehabbing at the moment. Are you able to share a little bit about how she's going with her rehab?
So, as I alluded to earlier, we had a couple of players go down with the injuries in the start of January, and one of those was Rosie Deegan, who was kind of here for her fifth year, and we were just quite gutted with that whole situation of kind of hurting herself in that way. A kid that had invested a lot in our program and really kind of came back to play for us because she had unfinished business and was seeing that, right? Like was seeing that with the win at, she played phenomenal in the win at Duke and being on a team that, a top 40 team in the country, receiving votes in the top 25, all of those things, and things just kind of falling into a heap for her with that knee injury. And so she actually had her surgery about 2 weeks ago now. So had her ACL repair. She's staying around here to kind of make sure she does the best in her rehab to set her up for her future professional career, whether that's playing in Europe or in the WNBL or what that looks like once her kind of rehab's over. So she'll be on about the 9-month plan of coming back to play as it stands now. And as I said, she's in early days. Definitely hoping for a really full and healthy recovery for her as she goes through that. Just never fun to see someone hurt their knee in that way. And particularly for their college career to end that way is pretty devastating.
In those situations as well, James, when you have a overseas college athlete, you know, like Rosie, obviously another one of our lovely Australians in your team, they do a season-ending injury in that situation. Do they usually have the choice whether to come home or not to rehab at home, or is it part of kind of like their scholarship to stay and rehab at college?
Yeah, I think it can go a variety of different ways, right? For Rosie, with it being the end of her career, that could have potentially gone a different way too. But from an insurance standpoint, from the access to the facilities that they have within our environment or within the majority of collegiate environments, it definitely is probably in their best interests to try to do as much of that rehab in those quarters as possible. Like they have basically full-time physical therapy through that phase, access to incredible sports medicine equipment. We're obviously also being in the Charlotte area. We've got kind of great access to the orthopedic people in this area too, in terms of who does the surgery, all that kind of thing. But in theory, it's up to them. But I think it's probably best practice for a kid like that to stick around and make sure they do it well, right? Because you really can't make up for doing a poor job in the first 4 months of an ACL recovery in terms of if you're wanting to have an extended kind of basketball future.
So you can't just come home and sit on the couch and watch maths.
probably not the best plan. And there's definitely some mourning involved, right? Obviously, that first stretch is for a kid, and it's any kid, whether it's a college kid or a teenager or a WNBL player, for them to go through a season-ending and often identity-shaping injury is a big deal. And so I think being able to wrap around the support for a person like that is really important. And I think we're really well served in the collegiate space to do that.
So we've already mentioned a couple of our Aussies already. You've got Izzy Morgan. You've also got Katie Donovan, Millie Pryor, you mentioned, Rosie Deegan and Charlize. And so getting into like the idea of how you go about recruiting and what you look for when you recruit new athletes to your team. I think before we have once spoken before where you've attended an under 17 and an under 19 World Cup. Is that right? Is that you that I've spoken to while you've been traveling around?
So I've typically kind of attended some stuff in Australia, usually Australian National Junior Championships. And then last year I went to the, was it last year? Well, I guess 22. So 2 years ago now, I went to the under 17 World Cup in Hungary. So that'll usually be a typical fashion, whether it's every year to go to one of those kind of events and year to year, depending on what's going on with the Australian space, trying to get down there is definitely a priority as well. COVID obviously got in the way of that for a little bit of that stretch in the past kind of 5 years or so, but now we're out of that. That's been my model.
And when you go to those international tournaments, does it make recruiting a little bit more difficult given the different styles of play across different international teams and systems, or have you got a pretty good idea of what you're looking for?
I think with recruiting, right, and with any form of scouting or projecting of talent, I think it's always beneficial to be able to watch players play against the best opponents they can, right? And sometimes you're having to forecast way further in the future, and you look at maybe an NBA team trying to do that and forecast kind of a really different level of play, and that becomes really hard, right? That's why you get so many misses in that level of scouting. And I think what we have an ability to do when we recruit internationally is potentially observe and evaluate players playing a level of basketball that's more similar to what our level is, right? If you compare that to what it might be like watching a high school kid down the road, well, the distance we have to project is way further. And so I do think that there is not that much different. Like when we talk about diversity of style of play, there's way more diversity of style of play within the college system than there would be between countries at an international event. And I'll put one small asterisk to that, and that would be that probably going to the Asia Cup is not the best strategy for me, right, in terms of watching Australia go against Japan and Korea and these teams that maybe top out at a kid that's 5'7", 5'8", and where it's just, quite frankly, is a completely different style of basketball. But at a world event, at a European event, I think that the level is pretty comparable, or at least stylistically, like we can see a lot of things that would be helpful. And I do think one component of evaluating, though, is that usually what you see is correct, right? So if someone performs really well, you like them, they're probably going to translate. It's probably going to be good. It's rare that it doesn't. But just because someone is not playing well at that level doesn't mean that they won't translate, I think is the other part. There might be a variety of different reasons. It may be opportunity, right? You think about someone like Izzy Morgan, who was probably in the last one or two picked on that under-19 team and didn't really get much court time at that under-19 National World Cup. Well, she showed up here and played every game as a freshman and was arguably the best freshman in our conference. And once again, she had opportunity. They were slightly different style or whatnot. But I think that's an important component when evaluating kids is to understand what you're not seeing, right? And what the potential may be for a kid like that.
So I just want to go back to something we touched on before. You know, you've got a lot of travel coming up. You've got 7 games, 3 at home and 4 away. When you're getting down at this end of the season, do you find that the travel is a little bit harder on the team and the travel schedule because it's you're getting down to that back end and there's post-regular season coming up as well?
Yeah, I think we always talk about, obviously, there's March Madness, right? And that's kind of the goal is to kind of play through to the point you're playing in that NCAA tournament, playing in March Madness. But the hardest time of the year to be a college basketball player is February. And some of that is, yeah, like you've got schools back started up after a winter break. And, yeah, you're at the pointy end of the season. You're banged up. Maybe you're playing with limited numbers. Like right now we're only dressing 8 players, right? So the bench is a little thin with those injuries that we've had now. And so, yeah, I think all those things add up. And one of the goals is to kind of weather that storm. And I think the reality is, well, everyone's going through it, right? Just because we're traveling 4 of those games. Well, everyone else is probably traveling somewhere between 3 or 4 of them as well. And they're going through it too. So I think it's just about being able to generate some mental rest for yourself too. And really at this time of year, it just, the habits are important, right? The habits of looking after your body and going and seeing the athletic trainer, and whether it's an ice bath here and there, or just looking after your soft tissues, or eating well, hydrating, sleeping, all of those things are magnified at this time of year. And I think we've done a nice job of kind of helping build some of those habits over the past 12 months. And we've won the last two. We've kind of started February off right this year. And hopefully we're on a bye week right now, but hopefully when we kind of come out of that stretch, we're feeling like we've done February well.
You mentioned March Madness. That's the kind of pinnacle of the NCAA season. But there's been a lot of, I mean, the truth is there's been a lot of chaos in the NCAA, especially like the last probably 2-3 weeks particularly. There's been a stream of stuff coming out, you know, and we've touched on it before, both with yourself and previous pod guest Amanda Kristovich, who's been doing a lot of reporting on what's been happening, you know, with teams moving to different conferences, the discussions about players, whether they should be classified as employees or not, court cases that are going on with NIL. Has all of this background stuff been affecting players, and not just at Davidson, but like across the board in terms of the whole uncertainty of the environment?
I think within the season, probably not so much. Like I think there's enough going on with what you're worried about from a game to game basis. Like we're playing every 3 days. Like you really don't have that much time to kind of sit back and kind of think about some of those things. But I'm sure there's this component, like the conference realignment stuff is a little tricky. Like those are lives that are changing, that kids have chosen to play at a certain place because they're regional to something. And now all of a sudden they're playing on a whole different coast of the country and whatnot. Some of that will play out as kind of next year rolls around when a lot of this is happening. But from the financial side, like for the most part for players, these are all beneficial changes, right? These are things moving more in the players' direction of what they're able to obtain from their collegiate experience. And so I think probably the mayhem is kept behind closed doors a little bit within administrators' offices on making sure they understand what's possible or understand how invested they are in seeing success within their respective programs, right? You've got a lot of schools over here that are football dominant, right? They're football is the cash cow, and that's kind of how everything rolls, and everything else is just extra. And so for those, what they're going to offer their women's basketball players or what they're going to be able to do for their women's basketball players is probably quite minimal as it compares to a school that maybe is all in on basketball, right? On being as good as possible in that phase. But yeah, you're right. There's a lot that's changing. Like we may see within the next month, the ability for schools to essentially pay student athletes, which is a far cry from when I first started here 12 years ago, or really a far cry from where we were 12 months ago. But I think ultimately, most of this stuff just ends up favoring the athlete in terms of what their experience is or what they get out of that time in college.
On the other side of it, there's been huge crowds rolling out for NCAA games, women's basketball, you know, and there's resale ticketing sites now that are obviously profiting from the whole process. In your opinion, what's been the big change to really get people out to these NCAA games, to women's basketball, in the numbers that they're coming out in?
Yeah, I think a lot of it's got to do with, and I think social media has played a role, right, in kind of magnifying the brands of some of these people. Yeah, like the ones that are selling out arenas are the Caitlin Clarks of the world, the LSUs of the world with Angel Reese and that crew. You've got South Carolina doing their thing with Dawn, and they've honestly been doing this for years now. This is not a new thing for them. This has been a last 5 or so year thing, that really since Asia Wilson was there, that they've been kind of selling out these arenas. But I think there's definitely been a steady uptick in terms of the exposure that women's sports is getting, and that's been really highlighted. Like what I've been really impressed with this year is just how many people are covering our game with regards to to online. There's a new article every day about women's basketball, or hundreds of new articles every day about women's basketball and the characters involved. And I think what's impressed me most is the nuance that a lot of these people have, these kind of new reporters are having on the game, and reflecting not just the characters involved, but also understanding what's happening in the basketball game too, right? And talking about the different strategies involved and talking about the analytics and all of these things, I think has been really, really impressive. But I do still think we're just kind of scratching the surface, even at kind of our level with what we're doing at Davidson. I think we've had maybe 7 nationally televised games this year that we've played in that gets broadcast to the entire United States that have cable. So that's a really big deal, right? This is not just streaming services that we're dealing with, but we're on national TV, and we're seeing more and more of those women's games being picked up and or being pushed to more prominent platforms. This year we've had, it's been games on Real Fox, right? Or on CBS or ABC, like real women's basketball games in that space that hadn't been there before. And so I think we'll see probably the NCAA tournament this year will break more numbers with their viewership. And that's just, yeah, I think reflective of the direction kind of women's basketball is heading.
And does this kind of like the increased exposure, some people have called it, you know, the Caitlin Clark effect, you know, I mean, I guess the Matildas had the Sam Kerr effect or whatever, but this increased exposure and attention and appreciation, does that trickle down to the players on the court, like even to your freshmen? Are they kind of aware of what's going on, and does it kind of influence them like on and off the court at all?
Yeah, I think it's hard to say how much influence them watching the game is. Like if that's the version of like our players, like are probably not trying to emulate Caitlin Clark. Like I don't think that at this level that's what they're doing. Now, yeah, when we get out this summer and watch the AU kids and see the 14, 15-year-olds running around, or they're all wearing their single leg sleeves like Angel Reese is or Asia Wilson was, or you definitely see that kind of stuff, right? But I think what's just cool in the collegiate space, and once again, you see this, I think, in all leagues, but what's been nice to be reminded of post the COVID period where some of this was kind of scaled back was just the importance of these athletes within the community, right? And some of the NIL stuff is really community-driven. They get to have more of a presence in the space. The community gets to support them in a variety of different ways and compensate them for that support as well. But that's the thing that's exciting to me, is just to see how a Rosie Deegan is received in our community, and how an Ellie Sutphin, who's a local North Carolina girl, is just like an absolute goddess to these girls around this area, is just really cool. And so I think there's like levels to all of this. And I do think, as I said, that there's been a way bigger awareness of what's happening in women's sport, and converting a lot of people that used to just go watch our men's team play to now coming and watching women's basketball on the regular and becoming season ticket holders and becoming really great supporters of our program.
You touched on the recognition that the players are getting in the community. Over the time you've been there, have you noticed an increase in connection between the community and the team? And also, how does that kind of play out in terms of, you know, just generally getting people into the games?
Yeah, I think we kind of had a goal to really increase our attendance this year, and we felt like we were going to be pretty good. And when we're kind of rolling in the early season stuff, it definitely led to more people coming and whatnot. I do think one of the special kind of traits of this Davidson environment and community is we have very few kids transfer out of our program. Most people stay for kind of all 4 years. Or we have obviously people that are transferring in kind of in the early phase of their career, right? Maybe after 1 year playing elsewhere. And so there is that affinity to these players that they've watched a Rosie Deegan play here for 5 years. They've watched an Ellie Sutphin play here for 3 years. Now Izzy Morgan in her third year. And being able to kind of be around that, like it goes for any league, right? If you're the Bendigo Spirit and you've got a player that's played there 8, 9, 10 years, well, obviously that player is going to be a favorite of that community, right? And so I think there's a big part of that. And yeah, like they come out to watch the team play and really support us in a variety of different ways. And you obviously see people that, yeah, have daughters and and kids in the community. They want these girls to be able to see these role models like they are, because they're brilliant humans. They're brilliant in the classroom. They're incredible on the basketball court, and they're going to have really awesome basketball futures too. And so I do think not every community is the same, but I do think within our community, we're seeing a lot of that. And you definitely see that in other areas where there's Australians too that are being rallied around by their local community, whether it be a Jazz Shelley in Nebraska who's been able to kind of make a mark on that area, or whether it's a Georgia Moore in Virginia Tech, or all those kind of places. Like, the community has probably been a major part of what their experience has been in those respective places.
I mean, I'm really curious about the fact that you've got this connection happening with your community. In terms of people then, players, you know, as you said, you see athletes that are playing there for several years. You get people transfer in, and very rarely do you get people transferring out. What sort of message do you see that as giving to the wider playing community across collegiate America in terms of the program at Davidson?
Yeah, I think that's one of the attractions to this place, right? And that's not just been a women's basketball thing. That's been a men's basketball thing when Bob McKillop was the coach here for 33 years. This was all about community. Anyone that's watched the underrated documentary that Steph put out middle of last year, which on Apple TV is just incredible, right? And yeah, I think that kind of hopefully what we will become known for, and this is a work in progress that we're building, but being a basketball community that's basketball centric and really looks after our players and gets around. And we're in a growing area of the United States too, like North Carolina's, and particularly the Charlotte area is one of the kind of biggest population growths of anywhere in the U.S. And so you've got this going on. You've got a lot of young kids around, and hopefully in a recruiting process, that's something that stands out to people that they want to be part of, right? They want to be part of this basketball community.
Translating all of that into future Australian talent incoming to Davidson, do you see that Australia is an area where Davidson's going to look to try and recruit more? Obviously, there's a connection with yourself in Australia.
What do you think? Yeah, so obviously it's been a robust pipeline for us so far in my time at Davidson, and that's kind of reflected of what are we up to now? 9 players from Australia that have kind of stepped foot on the basketball court here for us. That's right. And from all over Australia, and I think that their experiences kind of speak for themselves, right? You look at both the production that they've had, but also just their overall experience within our Davidson environment has been wholly positive. And that's reflected in someone like Charlize, for example, who looking for a new home last year, being like, yeah, well, what was your experience like, Millie and Izzy, in your last year here at Davidson? Okay, well, these are the things that I need to be thinking about. And part of recruiting, part of any process like that is trying to filter out what's true from what's not, right? Or what's true for me. And it's really difficult when you've got all these schools that are telling you things that may be true for some people, may not be true for you. And for an Australian kid to be able to speak to that and say, hey, well, what they've told me, and this was the case with Millie as well, when Izzy had kind of spent her freshman year here, and Izzy was like, well, actually, like, everything they told me was pretty much how this has gone down. And so that trust that's built up there is a really big deal. And we do have another Australian coming in our next class, in the 24 class, being Emily Bessel, who we might talk about shortly. But yeah, I think that's a thing that we're in a spot where hopefully have some proof of work, right? We've hopefully shown that this is a great location for them to have a good time, and still TBD on showing that work in terms of what their Davidson experience is going to look like for their future basketball careers. Like, we've got Cassidy Gould being the one that kind of left us 2 years ago. Unfortunately, was injured this past 12 months, but had a really great year in the Women's British Basketball League. But the proof will be in the pudding with Rosie Deegan when she leaves here, and so on, and what this experience had been in terms of transforming their basketball future. So I think that's a part of it. And yeah, we can speak, like, I coached Alex Sharp when we were at Wake Forest, and we can kind of speak to the success that she obviously had or is having now in the WNBL, or being a Fringe Opals member as well. And yeah, that's the goal, is to be able to kind of show that proof of work and just enjoy having them here, right? Enjoy leveling up their experiences and providing the best possible environment for an Australian to come to the whole other side of the world to pursue their dreams.
Yeah, so speaking of Emily Bessel, I suppose Emily being, as you mentioned, your new recruit, Izzy Morgan, your current third year over there. I don't know what's that. It's not sophomore. Is it a senior?
He's a junior right now.
Junior. Yep. I always get those ones mixed up. Being a junior, and they are both similar positions on court, but they're also both from North. So perhaps that channel of Izzy, you know, saying that she's enjoyed her experience at Davidson and everything that you guys offered has come to fruition. I mean, for Izzy to go back, you know, to North and say to someone like Emily, oh, look, it's great, I love it, that makes perfect sense as to why Emily would be more interested in Davidson. But how did someone like Emily come on your radar? Because I don't think she's always been a standout at state level for North or for New South Wales Metro, and she just participated in the under-20s as well. To my knowledge, I don't think she's ever gone to a junior championship yet, but how did she come up on your radar for recruitment?
Yeah, so she was someone, as you mentioned, coming from North as well. Typically, the New South Wales people have been a group that often we've had a lot of them through campus on different tours and whatnot. And yeah, became familiar with Emily through her performances at the Australian Junior Championships, and really thought she made some really awesome strides kind of in the last 12 months or so. Thought she played a pretty good under 18 national championships last year. Had a really strong team, right? That team stacked with having a really good bottom age group of girls that won under 16s the previous year, and thought she played really well at that event. And quite frankly, what kind of sold me on her was her subsequent performance at the National Junior Classic, where her North team won a gold medal. And I just thought she played really assertively in that and showed me some things that I'd been wanting to see from her. And I thought we were a great fit from her. Obviously, there was a connection through Izzy. And I think the other part of what I know about Australia, or what I know about most of these players, is they're just getting phenomenal coaching in the lead up to coming here, right? They're just way more prepared than probably a typical American kid coming from any random high school or AU program is. Like, to be getting mentored on a daily basis right now, or over the past 12 months, and even for the coming 7 months by Tom and Renee Gallup, like, who better to mentor an 18-year-old girl before their college basketball experience than those two, right? You've got Tom as the head coach of the under-17 Australian team, and just does a phenomenal job when they're playing in the national championships. And then Renee was on an Opal staff, 6 months ago? And so I think that really special environment they've got there, and really excited for what she's going to be able to bring, and still think she's got her best basketball well ahead of her. Like, she had a phenomenal week at the under 20 national championships, was I think the sixth leading scorer at the entire event, and just played some really good basketball. So hopefully she can kind of crack into kind of an Australian team in the coming year or two. Like, I think she's definitely in the mix for that potentially now. But yeah, really excited for what she could bring. And she was number 40. Izzy was number 44, and she also wore number 44 at North's. So pretty awesome connection there.
Yeah, I didn't know that they connected on that level of wearing the same number either. So, but you know, in however many years' time, when it comes to retiring number 44 in the North rafters, is it going to say Morgan or is it going to say Bessel?
Yeah, hopefully it says both, right?
Yeah.
It says both. And I still have the question of what guard at 5'9 or whatever they are decides that 44 is their number. But won't hold that against him. Izzy actually changed this year. She felt like she was more of a number 4 than a 44. So she made that transition this year to kind of drop one.
Okay, going singular. Okay.
Yep. Just going the one.
So I'm kind of curious about the mechanics of how you scout here in Australia. Obviously, you're getting feedback from people who are on the ground here. You're seeing film. Do you ever get to the point where it's like, we've got to actually get on the ground and sort of scout some of these people? And how do you do that? Because obviously everyone's going to know you're going to be around. In practical terms, how does that work?
Yeah, it's a little tricky, and honestly, the biggest barrier is the NCAA's recruiting rules around recruiting calendar. So unfortunately, there's a lot of events that are not practical or not allowed for us to attend. So for example, under-20s national championships, we're in the middle of our season, not a real practical thing for us to bop on down and go watch that. So most of that is probably there's probably not a more avid follower of Australian National Junior Championships on the women's girls side than me in terms of watching as many games. So that's kind of how I have to deal with the under-20s, with the under-18s. It typically falls outside of our recruiting windows. So that's one that we typically cannot attend. And so the 16s does fall within a window that we can attend. And so in the past, I have attended that several times. And that's obviously they're still young at that point, but typically the best 10 or so players at a 16 national championship tend to at least be 10 of the best 15 players or so, at least on the girls' side, when they get to under-18s or get to under-20s. There's not as much movement as there's probably on the boys' side with kind of talent differentiation at that age. So that's been helpful for me. Often players come on tours over here as well, so sometimes we see that. But I do rely, particularly early on in the recruiting process with players, a lot on recommendations of people that I trust that are kind of getting to work with them every day. And then the other barrier to our recruitment at Davidson is that we're an extremely highly academic institution. And so for every four players that maybe I like the way they play down there, I think they could play at our level, there may only be one or two of them that could be admissible into Davidson in the first place. And so we try to get that information pretty early on and in terms of what that's going to look like, whether Davidson's going to be a possibility for them. And yeah, that's typically how it kind of works for us.
It's interesting when you say that about the academics, because I suppose there's a perception that most colleges don't focus on the academics, right? Rightly or wrongly. So when you say Davidson has a focus on academics, for people who are listening who may not really understand what that means, can you just give us a bit of a rundown on what that is?
Yeah, so like we're a small private school that essentially is competing for students within the United States with schools like the Ivy League. So people are making the choice to come to Davidson and maybe schools like Harvard, Princeton, Columbia, Yale, Penn, those types of schools may be schools that they're also considering. Large proportion of our student body will want to become doctors and lawyers and CEOs and do really big things in the world. And so often the way that I like to kind of equate it for an Australian conversion is pretty much everyone at Davidson probably had an ATAR score of probably 90 plus.
Wow.
And the majority, and that's including our student athletes. So very rare, there might be the occasional person has less than that, but the majority you're talking, yeah, in that 90 plus range for an ATAR score. So that's usually probably the best conversion in terms of an Australian understanding, kind of the high academic nature of this place.
And this is kind of for my curiosity as well. Are there particular subject areas that Davidson's known for?
A bit of everything. So we're what's called a liberal arts college. And so there is a little less focus on being really specific with disciplines. But you got a lot of probably our most predominant majors would be, I said, things like biology. Often those are people that want to go down what I'd call like the pre-professional health track, whether that's medical school or dentistry or physical therapy or nutrition, dietetics, nursing, that kind of route. That would be a lot of people would kind of do the sciences. A lot of people would do economics, which is kind of the business version of things, political science, so maybe kind of international affairs or law or those kind of things. And then psychology is probably the other most common one. And obviously people can go in a variety of different directions from that too. But those are probably our top four majors in terms of overall number. But yeah, have a bit of everything.
Okay.
When we were growing up in our junior state programs like ITC, which is now what? SPP?
NITP, yeah, I guess it's NPP, SPP. Yeah.
Yeah, whatever it's called now, it's evolved. Same program, different acronym.
Yep.
But they always had a strong focus on being able to balance your basketball schedule with your school schedule and making sure that you're still staying on top of your schoolwork. And I remember, I think we had boomers or something at a camp say, yeah, you've got to stay in school and stay smart at school, because if you're smart at school, then you'll be smart on the basketball court. And so now me as an adult, and I'll, yes, yeah, I can see your reaction, because me as an adult, I was like, I can't tell if that was just something a boomer told us to be a good representation and make sure we did the right thing and stay in school, or if that was actually true, being smart in the classroom makes you a smarter basketball player. What are you seeing over there in your long college coaching career? Are the smarter athletes in the classroom also the smarter ones on court?
So given how incredibly intelligent the majority of our team is, they do a lot of dumb stuff. Yeah, I'd like to think we usually, like, we'll use that as a bit of a comment to them sometimes. It's like, y'all are meant to be the smart ones, right? Yeah. It's like, if you're struggling with this, but yeah, I don't know if there's that much of a correlation between those things in terms of being basketball smart and book smart. But I do think what there is a correlation between is having high performance habits. Right. And you can't be good in the classroom if you're not looking after yourself. Right. If you're not sleeping, if you're not organized, if you don't have your priorities in line, you're not going to be good in the classroom. And so I think it's those human components that can lead to being good in both of those things. And there's obviously outliers, but very difficult to be an exceptional high level basketball player without being a pro. Right, without having your ducks in a row and handling your business. And maybe there's other areas of your life that you're not handling business in, but you're prioritizing the fact that you're kind of doing things as you need to as a professional in a basketball sense. And so I think that's where you probably see that crossover, is maybe dealing with stress or handling things in a different kind of way. These people that are high aptitude may be better at doing something like that. But yeah, smart kids still do dumb stuff.
Put that part on a t-shirt.
Yeah, and especially when they're 18 to 22 year old too, right?
Yeah. To their defense, their brain is still developing, I think, that's up until 22, 25.
We'll roll with that.
We'll roll with that. So yeah, my kids still do dumb stuff. But yeah, that's funny. That's because I always wondered that, thinking, I don't know if that's entirely true, but. You know, the other thing that you mentioned is how when they're in that situation of juggling being a college athlete and having to perform well in the classroom, under those particular circumstances and I guess stresses, is when you really learn, like properly learn, or a more meaningful lesson in how to handle those things in life, like tolerating stress, like understanding that you need to look after your nutrition and your sleep and those things, which are the boring things of life and being an adult, but being able to develop those habits and how important they are for every aspect of life. Because we can all kind of imagine, out of the context of someone being a college athlete or not having to go through any of those kind of different stresses or situations in life, you may not have that opportunity to learn those things. So it's harder when you become I'm supposed to be a proper adult. You're past age 22.
Yeah, totally. And I think it's like, it's reflective, and this is something that's used a lot in the athletic space within the collegiate environment, but you kind of look at most of the female leaders in America in terms of whether they're CEOs, but there's usually numbers floating around that probably 3 in every 4 female CEOs in America of kind of high-end companies are former student athletes, right? And that comes because, once again, there's a lot of things that you can learn from having to perform at that level and work in teams and prioritize your schedule and do those things, be a high achiever, that crosses over with what life looks like after that. And the one thing I will say with some of those habits, the sleep, the nutrition, and those kind of things, is it's something you do have to be intentional about, though. It's not something that just comes from the pressure, right, that you just figure it out, that, okay, that's what's going to happen. Like, it's something that organizations have to be pretty intentional about, or players, athletes have to be pretty intentional about taking a step back and actually evaluating how things work for them. And I think we've done a pretty nice job of that here, of providing those resources to our players and trying to help them navigate, kind of figuring out what works for them. But it's not something just that just happens.
So finally, before we get to the end of the podcast, for you over the next few years, do you have specific professional goals that you've set for yourself?
Yeah, I think there's I've always been someone that's kind of just tried to really live in the moment with where I'm at. I obviously came to this path in a very non-traditional way to a lot of people have. And I think my primary professional goal is to continue to build what we have at Davidson to be as I think what our men's program has been, right? Where they've been perennially successful and be in a spot where we're considered one of the best teams in the Atlantic 10. Like when I first got here, we came into a program that only won 6 games the year before, right? That had basically only won, I think it was 4 conference games over the previous 2 years combined. And so I think continuing to build this program to be something that's memorable, that there's a legacy there, that there's something special about what Davidson women's basketball is, I think that's number one. I think number two, I'd love to kind of supplement my situation here with coaching at the international level. So definitely have high hopes of doing that, whether it's at a junior international championships or within a senior program, being something that I'd love to do. And then down the path, I definitely wouldn't write off the idea of becoming a Division I head coach at some point. Definitely not something I'm looking to do in the kind of next 1 or 2 years. Like it's not at the front of my focus right now. But I do think it would be pretty cool to say that I was the first Australian to coach an NCAA Division I women's basketball program as a head coach. I think that would be a pretty cool bucket list item, but not something anytime soon, but something I definitely want to be prepared for down the track if it was to happen.
That's cool. Well, we certainly hope that you get to achieve all of those goals. James, thanks so much for joining us. It's been great having you back on the show and getting deeper into what's happening in the college world and also at Davidson. And thanks so much for joining us again.
Oh, yeah. Thanks so much for having me. And let's hope the Opals can pull things out, can qualify for the Olympics.
Absolutely. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you get our latest pod. And we really appreciate if we could get a like and a review so we can extend the reach to more listeners. And don't forget, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn.